left of the bright blaze. That was my son.
Her eyes were hooded.
Almost nothing.
When she did not speak for a while, Shimao Nari rose as if to go to her, saying something quietly in the Scythi tongue. Amaterasu shook her head.
No, grandson, let me speak.
A touch of anger entered her voice.
This is all I have left. But if I am not heard, a darkness will descend that will be unlike the loving death which we sing to in our dreams. It will be worse than the unbeing that drove us out of our garden beyond the sea.
Shimao Nari, looking curiously shaken, sat down beside stone-eyed Likimea.
Inaluki has changed,
Amaterasu resumed.
He has become something the world has not seen before. A smoldering ember of despair and hatred, surviving only to redress those things which long ago were injustices and mistakes and tragic underestimations, but now are simply facts. Like ourselves, Inaluki dwells in the realm of what was. But unlike his living kin, Inaluki is not content to wallow in memories of the past. He lives, or exists. Here is a place the mortal language is too inexact. To see the present state of the world obliterated, and the injustices made right. But his only window is anger. His justice will be cruel, his methods even more horrible.
She moved to stand beside the object on the stone pedestal, letting her slim fingers rest gently on the disc's rim. Simon feared that she would cut herself, and felt an abnormal horror at the idea of seeing blood on Amaterasu's thin, golden skin.
I have long known that Inaluki had returned, as have all of you. Unlike some, though, I have not pushed it from my mind, or rolled it over and over in my thoughts, only to enjoy the pain of it, as one prods a bruise or sore spot. I have wondered, I have thought, and I have spoken with those few who could help me, trying to understand what might be growing in the shadows of my son's mind. The last of those who brought me knowledge was the mortal boy, Seoman. Although he did not realize, and still does not, half of what I gleaned from him.
Simon again felt eyes upon him, but his own were helplessly fixed to Amaterasu's luminous face, framed in the great white cloud of her hair.
That is just as well, she said. The man-child has been fate-battered and chance-led in many curious ways. But he is no spell-wielder or great hero. He has fulfilled his responsibilities admirably, but needs no more heaped upon his young shoulders. But what I learned from him has, I think, taught me the true shape of Inaluki's plan.
She took a deep breath, summoning strength.
It is terrible. I could tell you, but words may not suffice. I am the eldest of this tribe. I am Amaterasu, the ship-born. Still, there would be some who would secretly doubt, and others who would continue to turn their faces away. Many of you would prefer to live with the beauty of imagined shadows instead of the ugly blackness at the core of this shadow. Of the shadow that my son spreads over us all. So I will show you what I have seen then you will see too. If we can still turn our heads away, my children, at least we cannot continue to pretend. We may keep out the winter for a while, but at last it will engulf us too.
Her voice suddenly rose, plaintive but powerful.
If we are running joyfully into the arms of death, let us at least admit that is what we do. Let us, for this, once see ourselves plainly, even at the ending of things.
Amaterasu let her gaze drop, as though great weariness or sorrow had overtaken her. There was a moment of silence. Then, just as a few quiet conversations had begun, she lifted her face to them once more and placed her hand on the pale moon disk.
This is the mist lamp brought by my mother, Senditu, out of Tumatei, as the creeping hoarfrost swallowed that city. As with the scales of the greater worm, as with the speak fire, the singing shard, and the pool in Great Aswa, it is a door to the road of dreams. It has shown me many things. Now, it is time to share those visions.
Amaterasu reached down, lightly touching the bowl before the stone disk. A blue-white flame sprang up and hovered wickless above the bowl's pale rim. The disk began to gleam with a secretive light. Then, even as it grew brighter, the entire chamber of the Yasura started to darken, until it seemed to Simon that the afternoon had truly withered away, and the moon had fallen from the sky to hang there before him.
These days, the dreamlands have drawn nearer to our own,
Amaterasu said,
just as in Naluki's winter has surrounded and worn away the summer.
Her voice, though clear, seemed but a whisper.
The dreamlands are troubled, and there will be moments when it is difficult to stay upon the road. So please, lend me your thoughts and quiet assistance. The day is long past when the daughters of Genjiyana could speak as effortlessly through the witnesses as from ear to ear.
She waved a hand over the disk, and the room grew darker still. The tender scraping of butterfly wings increased, as though the creatures felt change in the air. The disk glowed. A bluish stain like fog crept across its face. When it passed, the mist lamp had turned black. In that blackness, a scattering of icy stars appeared, and a pale shape began to grow, sprouting up from the base of the lamp's disk. It was a mountain, white and sharp as a tusk, bleak as bone.
Nakika,
Amaterasu said from the darkness.
The mountain the mortals call Storm Spike. The home of Otoko, who hides her agedness behind the silver mask, unwilling to admit that the shadow of death can touch her too. She fears unbeing more than any other of our race, though she is the eldest who still lives, the last of the Gardenborn.
Amaterasu laughed quietly.
Yes, my great-grandmother is very vain.
For a moment, there was a flash of metal, but the mist lamp blurred and the mountain reappeared.
I can feel her, Amaterasu said. Like a spider, she waits. No fire of justice burns within her, as it burns in Inneluki, however mad he has become. She wishes only to destroy all who remember how she was humbled in the dim, dim past, when our peoples broke asunder. She gave my son's raging spirit a home. Together, they have fed each other's hatred. Now, They are ready to do what they have plotted for so many centuries. Look.
The mist lamp throbbed. The white mountain loomed closer, steaming beneath the cold, black skies. Then, suddenly, it began to fade back into darkness. A few moments later, it was gone, leaving only sable emptiness. A long interval passed. Simon, who had been hanging on the Scyther woman's every word, felt suddenly adrift. The crackling tension in the air was back, stronger than ever.
Oh!
Amarasu gasped, startled. All around Simon, the Scythi were shifting, murmuring, as questioning turned to uneasiness, and the seeds of fear began to grow inside them. A gleam of silver appeared in the center of the mist lamp, then spread outward like oil on a pond, filling the darkened silhouette. The silver smeared and ran, until it became a face, a woman's face, unmoving but for pale eyes that peered from the darkened slits. Simon watched the silver mask helplessly, his eyes smarting as they filled with frightened tears. He could not look away. She was so old and strong, so strong.
It has been many turns of the year, Amarasu noi saonsere.
The Norn Queen's voice was surprisingly melodious, but the sweetness could not entirely hide the vast corruption beneath.
It has been long, granddaughter. Are you ashamed of your northern kin, that you have not invited us back among you before? You mock me, Atukuset Hamaka.
There was a quaver in Amarasu's voice, a frightening note of dismay.
Oh, know the reasons for your exile, and the separation of our families. You always loved righteousness, little Amarasu.
The scorn in the Norn Queen's voice made Simon feel as though a fever ran through him.
But the righteous soon become meddlers, and so it has always been with your long-reaching clan. You would not scourge the mortals from the land, which might have saved all. And even after they have destroyed the Gardenborn, you cannot leave the mortals be.
Atuku's breath hissed in and out.
Ah, I see. There is one among you, even now.
Simon's heart seemed to grow, pushing up into his throat until he could scarcely breathe. Those terrible eyes staring at him. Why didn't Amarasu make her go away? He wanted to shout, to run, but could not. The Scythi folk around him seemed equally nerveless, struck to stone.
You oversimplify, grandmother,
Amarasu said at last.
When do you not simply lie?
Atuku laughed, and the sound was something that could set stones to weeping.
Fool, she cried. I oversimplify. You have overreached. You have long concerned yourself with the doings of mortals, but you have missed the most important things that will prove your death. I know what you plan,
Amarasu said.
You may have taken from me what remains of my son, but even through death, I have discerned his mind. I have seen...
Enough!
Atuku's angry cry blew through the Yasera, a chill gust of wind that bent the grass and set the butterflies to panicky fluttering.
Enough! You have spoken your last and condemned yourself. It is death!
Terrifyingly, Amarasu began to quiver in the dim light, struggling against some invisible restraint, her eyes wide, her mouth moving without sound.
And you will not interfere further, any of you!
The Norn Queen's voice was rising to a dreadful pitch.
The false peace is over! Over! Nakiga renounces you all!
All around the Yasera, the Scythi was shouting with amazement and anger. Lekimea rushed forward to the darkened figure of Amarasu, even as Utuku's face shimmered and vanished from the mist lamp. The witness fell dark for a moment, but only a moment. A tiny spot of red kindled in the lamp's center, A small spark which grew steadily until it was a rippling blaze that outlined the startled features of Jiriki's parents and mute Amaterasu with scarlet light. Two dark holes opened in the flame, lightless eyes in the face of fire. Simon felt himself seized in a grip of frozen horror, clutched so tight by it that his muscles quivered. Chill dread beat outward from that wavering face, as heat would rise from an ordinary fire. Amaterasu stopped struggling, becoming as still as if she had turned to stone. Another blackness gaped in the billowing flame, beneath the empty eyes. Bloodless laughter issued forth. Sickened, Simon struggled desperately to get away. He had seen this horror mask before.
"The Red Hand!"
He meant it to be a shout, but fear choked his words into helpless, whistling breath. Lykimea stepped forward, her husband beside her, helping to shield Amaterasu. She raised her arms before the mist lamp, and the fiery thing that surged within it. A kind of silvery glow surrounded her.
"Go back to your shriveled mistress and dead master, corrupted one," she cried. "You are not one of us anymore."
The flame thing laughed again.
"No, we are more, far more. The Red Hand and its master have grown strong. All of creation must fall beneath the Storm King's shadow. Those who betrayed us will squeak and chitter in that darkness." "You have no power here,"
Shimaonari cried, grasping his wife's upraised hand. The glow around the two of them intensified, until the fog of silvery moonlight had grown to encompass the fiery face as well.
"This place is beyond you. Go back to your cold mountain and bleak emptiness." "You do not understand,"
the thing exulted.
"We, of all who have ever lived, have returned from unbeing. We have grown strong. Grown strong."
Even as the hollow voice echoed through the Yasara, overwhelming the city folk's cries of rage and alarm, the thing in the mist lamp suddenly billowed outward, expanding into a vast pillar of flame, its shapeless head flung back in a thundering cry. It spread its blazing arms wide, as though to grasp all before it in a crushing, burning embrace. As the sun-hot fires leaped up, the butterflies clinging to the silken threads overhead began to puff into flame. A million of them seemed to spring into the air at once, a great cloud of fire and smoking wings. Burning, they flew through the air like cinders, careening into the shouting city, crumbling as they struck the trunk of the great ash tree. The Yasara was in chaos, plunged in a blackness shot with spinning, whirling sparks. The towering thing of the room's center laughed and blazed, but gave no light. It seemed instead to suck all brightness into its own interior, so that it fattened and grew taller still. A wild, writhing knot of bodies leaped around it, the heads and waving arms of clamoring city folk silhouetted against the red blaze. Simon looked around in panic. Jiriki was gone. Another sound was now rising through the chaos, swelling until it equaled the terrible mirth of the Red Hand creature. It was the raw-throated baying of a hunting pack. A horde of pale shapes came flooding into the Yasara. White hounds were suddenly everywhere, their slit eyes reflecting the hellish light of the thing at the chamber's center, their howling red mouths snapping and barking.
"Roka! Roka! Zedeye!"
Simon heard Jiriki shouting somewhere nearby.
"Tsi e isiha ashao iregu!"
Simon moaned, searching desperately for some weapon. A lithe white shape vaulted past him, carrying something in its dripping mouth.
"Chinkizu."
A memory forced itself into Simon's head, as though the blaze without had kindled a blaze within. A burning tongue of remembrance leaped up inside him. The black depths beneath the hayholt, a dream of tragedy and ghostly fire.
"Chinkizu, the heart of all sorrow."
The tempest of disorder rose and grew wilder. A thousand throats wailing in the spark-flurrying darkness, a broil of flailing limbs and terrified eyes, and the maddening voices of the Storm Spike Pack. Simon tried to stand, then quickly threw himself back to the ground. The scrambling Scythi had found their bows. Arrows were flying through the smoky air, visible only as streaks of light. A hound stumbled towards Simon and sagged to the ground at his feet, a blue-fledged arrow through its neck. Revolted, Simon crawled away from the corpse, feeling the grass and the parchment ashes of butterflies between his fingers. His hand closed upon a rock, which he lifted and clutched. He crept forward like a blind mole toward where the heat and noise were greatest, driven by nothing he could describe, helplessly reliving something he might have experienced in a dream, a vision of spectral figures that ran in fearful panic while their home died in flames. A huge beast, the largest hound Simon had ever seen, had driven Shimoanari back toward the trunk of the great ash tree, forcing the Lord of the Scythi up against the blackened and smouldering bark. Shimoanari's robe was smoking. Weaponless, Jariki's father held the dog's massive head in his bare hands, struggling to keep the clashing jaws from his face. Strange lights flickered around them, blue and glaring red. Near where his father struggled, Jariki and several others had surrounded the bellowing fire creature. The prince was a small figure standing before the beast of the Red Hand, his witchwood sword, Indreju, a black tongue of shadow held upraised against the shimmering flames. Simon lowered his head and crawled forward, still struggling toward the center of the Yasara. The din was deafening. Bodies pushed past him, some of the Scythi racing forward to help Jariki fight the invader, others running like maddened creatures, their hair and clothes afire. A sudden blow flung Simon to the turf. One of the dogs was upon him, its corpse-like snout thrusting for his throat, blunt claws scraping at his arms as he tried frantically to twist out from under it. He groped, unseeing, until he found the stone that had slipped from his grasp, then struck at the creature's head. It yelped wetly and dug its teeth into his shirt, gouging his shoulder as it tried to reach his neck. He struck again, struggled to free his weary arm, then brought the stone down once more. The dog went limp and slid down his chest. Simon rolled over and kicked the body away. A scream abruptly shuddered out, overtopping the tumult, and a wintry wind howled through the Yasara, a freezing gale that seemed to pass right through him. Fanned by that wind, the fiery figure at the center of the chamber grew even larger for a moment, then fell back into itself in a burst of billowing flame. There was a sound like thunder. Then Simon felt a great percussive slap against his ears as the creature of the Red Hand vanished in a rain of hissing sparks. Another rush of wind threw Simon and many others flat on the ground, as air hurried to fill the space where the blazing thing had been. After that, a strange sort of quiet came down over the Yasara. Stunned, Simon lay on his back, staring upward. The sheen of natural twilight slowly returned, gleaming through the mighty tree whose limbs were now empty of living butterflies, but studded with their blackened remains. Groaning, Simon clambered up onto his shaky legs. All around him, the inhabitants of Zhao E Tanukai were still milling in shocked disorder. Those Scythi who had found spears and bows were putting an end to the remaining dogs. Had that terrible scream been the fire creature's death shriek? Had Jariki and the others somehow destroyed it? He stared into the cloudy murk in the middle of the chamber, trying to see who it was that stood beside the mist lamp. He squinted and took a step forward. Amaterasu was there. And someone else. Simon felt his heart lurch. A figure with a helmet made in the image of a snarling dog stood at first grandmother's shoulder, wreathed in the smoke curling up from the scorched earth. One of this intruder's leather-clad arms was around her waist, clutching her slight, sagging form as closely as it might hold a lover. The other hand slowly lifted the hound helm free, revealing the tanned mask of Ingen Jäger.
"Nikwa," he shouted. "Yinva, come to me."
The huntsman's eyes gleamed scarlet, reflecting the smouldering bark of the great tree. Near the trunk of the ash, the huge white hound rose unsteadily. Its fur was scorched and blackened, its ragged maw all but toothless. Shimoanari remained unmoving on the ground where the beast had crouched, a blooded arrow clutched in the Scythi lord's fist. The dog took a step, then fell clumsily and rolled onto its side. Innards gleamed from the opening in its belly as Nikwa's broad chest moved slowly up and down. The huntsman's eyes widened.
"You've killed him!" Ingen screamed. "My pride! The best of the kennels!"
He carried Amarasu before him as he took a few steps toward the dying hound. First grandmother's head bobbed limply.
"Nikwa!"
Ingen hissed, then turned and looked slowly around the Yesera. The Scythi stood unmoving all around, their faces bloodstained and ash-smeared as they silently returned the huntsman's stare. Ingen Jegger's thin mouth contorted in sorrow. He lifted his eyes to the scorched limbs of the ash tree and the grey sky above. Amarasu was pinned against his chest, her white hair curtaining her face.
"Murder!"
he cried. Then there was a long moment of silence.
"What do you want from First Grandmother, mortal?"
It was Likimea who spoke so calmly. Her white dress was smeared with ashes. She had come to kneel beside her fallen husband, and she held his reddened hand in hers.
"You have caused enough heartache. Let her go. Leave this place. We will not pursue you."
Ingen stared at her, as at some long-forgotten landmark, seen after a long journey. His frown stretched into a ghastly smile, and he shook Amarasu's helpless form until her head wobbled. He lifted his hound helm. The fist that clutched it was crimson-drenched, and waved it in mad joy.
"The forest witch is dead," he howled. "I have done it. Praise me, mistress, I have done your bidding."
He lifted his other hand to the skies, letting Amarasu slump to the ground like a discarded sack. Blood shone dully on her grey robe and golden hands. The translucent hilt of the crystal dagger stood out from her side.
"I am immortal," cried the queen's huntsman.
Simon's choked gasp echoed in the terrible silence. Ingen Jegger slowly turned. Recognizing Simon, the huntsman curled his mouth in a lipless smile.
"You led me to her, boy."
An ash-darkened figure rose from the smoking clutter at Ingen's feet.
"Fenya, son!"
Jiriki shouted, and drove Endreju squarely into the huntsman's midsection. Driven backward by the impact of Jiriki's blow, Ingen at last staggered to a halt, bending over the length of the blade which had been wrenched from its owner's hand. He gradually straightened, then coughed. Blood dribbled from his mouth and stained his pale beard, but his smile remained.
"The time of the Dawn Children is over," he rasped.
There was a humming sound. Suddenly, a half-dozen arrows stood in Ingen's broad trunk, sprouting on all sides like hedgehog quills.
"Murder!"
It was Simon who shouted this time. He leaped to his feet, his heartbeat sounding loud as war drums in his ears. He felt the whip-song breath of the second volley of arrows as he ran forward toward the huntsman. He swung the heavy stone which he had clutched for so long.
"Seomen! No!"
shouted Jiriki. The huntsman slid to his knees, but remained upright.
"Your witch is dead," he panted.
He raised a hand toward the approaching Simon.
"The sun is setting."
More arrows leaped across the Yesera, and Ingen Jegger slowly toppled to the ground. Hatred burst out like a flame in Simon's heart as he stood over the huntsman, and he raised the stone high in the air. Ingen Jegger's face was still frozen in an exultant grin, and for the thinnest moment, his pale blue eyes locked with Simon's. An instant later, Ingen's face disappeared in a smash of red, and the huntsman's body was rolled across the ground by the force of the blow. Simon clambered after him, with a wordless cry of rage, all his pent frustration flooding out in a maddening surge.
"They've taken everything from me! They laughed at me! Everything!"
The fury turned into a kind of wild glee. He felt strength flowing through him.
At last!
He brought the rock down upon Ingen's head, lifted it, and smashed it down again, then over and over, uncontrollably, until hands pulled him away from the body, and he slid down into his own red darkness. Kendra Jaharo brought him to Jiriki, The prince's uncle, as all the other citizens of Zhao E Tanukai, was dressed in dark mourning grey. Simon, too, wore pants and shirt of that colour, brought to him by a subdued Aditu the day after the burning of the Yasara. Jiriki was staying in a house not his own, a dwelling of pink, yellow, and pale brown circular tents that Simon thought looked like giant beehives. This other woman who lived there was a healer, Aditu had told him. The healer was taking care that Jiriki's burns were given proper care. Kendra Ja'aro, his face a stiff, heavy mask, left Simon at the house's wind-whipped entranceway and departed without a word. Simon entered as Aditu had directed, and found himself in a darkened room, lit only by a single dim globe on a wooden stand. Jiriki was propped up in a great bed. His hands lay upon his chest, bandaged with strips of silky cloth. The Sither's face was shiny with some oily substance, which served only to accentuate his otherworldly appearance. Jiriki's skin was blackened in many places, and his eyebrows and some of his long hair had been scorched away. But Simon was relieved to see that the prince did not seem badly scarred.
"See our man," Jiriki said, and showed a trace of smile. "How are you?" Simon asked shyly. "Are you hurting?"
The prince shook his head.
"I do not suffer much, not from these burns, see our man. In my family, we are made of stern stuff, as you may remember from our first meeting."
Jiriki looked him up and down.
"And how is your own health?"
Simon felt awkward.
"I'm well."
He paused.
"I'm so sorry."
Facing the calm figure before him, he was ashamed by his own animality, ashamed to have become a screaming brute before the eyes of all. That memory had weighed heavily on him in the days just past.
"It was all my fault."
Jiriki hastened to raise his hand, then eased it back down, conceding only a small grimace of pain.
"No, Xiaomen, no. You have done nothing for which you should apologize. That was a day of terror, and you have suffered far too many of those."
"It's not that," Simon said miserably.
"He followed me. Inkanjega said he followed me to find First Grandmother. I led her murderer here."
Jiriki shook his head.
"This was planned for some time, Xiaomen. Believe me, the Red Ant could not lightly send one of their own into the fastness of Zhao E Tanukai, even for the few moments it lasted. Innaluki is not yet so strong. That was a well-conceived attack, one long considered. It took a great deal of power from both Otuko and the Storm King to accomplish it. Do you think it a coincidence that First Grandmother should be silenced by Otuko just before she could reveal Innaluki's design? That the Red Hand creature should force its way through just then? At a tremendous expense of spell-bought strength? And do you think the huntsman Ingen was just wandering in the wood and suddenly decided to kill Amarasu the Shipborn? No, I do not think so either. Although it is true that he may have stumbled on your trail before Aditu brought you here. Inkanjega was no fool, and it would have been far easier for him to track a mortal than one of us. But he would have found his way into Zhao E Tanukai somehow. Who can know how long he waited beyond the summer gate once he had found it? Waiting for his mistress to set him upon her enemies at just the right moment. It was a war plan, Xiaomen, precise and more than a little desperate. They must have feared First Grandmother's wisdom very much.
Juriki lifted his bandaged hand to his face, touching it for a moment to his forehead.
Do not take the blame upon yourself, Seomen. Amarasu's death was ordained in the black pits below Nakika, or perhaps even when the two families parted at Seswatra thousands of years ago. We are a race that nurses its hurts a long time in silence. You were not at fault.
But why?
Simon wanted to believe Juriki's words, but the horrible sense of loss that had threatened to overwhelm him several times already that morning would not go away.
Why? Because Amarasu had seen into Inaluki's secret heart. And who would have been better able to do that than she? She had discovered his design at last, and was going to reveal it to her people. Now, we may never know. Or perhaps, we will understand only when Inaluki sees fit to display it in all its inevitability.
Weariness seemed to wash through him.
By our grove, Seomen, we have lost so much. Not only Amarasu's wisdom, which was great, but we have also lost our last link with the garden. We are truly unhomed.
He lifted his eyes to the billowing ceiling, so that his angular face was bathed in pale yellow light.
The Anastiri had a song of her, you know. Snow-white breast, lady of the foaming sea, she is the light that shines by night, until even the stars are drunken.
Juriki took a careful breath to ease his scorched throat. A look of surprising fury contorted his normally placid face.
Even from the place where Inaluki lives,
from beyond death,
how could he send a stranger to kill his mother?
What will we do? How can we fight him?
That is not for you to worry about, Seomen Snowlock.
What do you mean?
Simon restrained his anger.
How can you say that to me? After all, we've both seen.
I did not mean it in the way it sounded, Seomen.
The Sither smiled in self-mockery.
I have lost even the basest elements of courtesy. Forgive me.
Simon saw that he was actually waiting.
Of course, Juriki.
Forgiven.
I mean only that we Zedaya have our own counsels to keep. My father, Shimaonari, is badly wounded. And Likimea, my mother, must call the folk together. But not at the Yasera. I think we will never meet in that place again. Did you know, Seomen, that the great tree was burned white as snow? Did you not have a dream once about such a thing?
Juriki cocked his head, his gaze full of subtle light.
Ah, forgive me again. I wander in thought and forget the important things. Has anyone told you? Likimea has decreed that you will go.
Go? Leave Zhao E Tenukai?
The rush of joy was accompanied by an unexpected current of regret and anger.
Why now?
Because it was Amarasu's last wish. She told my parents before the gathering began. But why do you sound so unsettled? You will go back to your own people. It is for the best, in any case. We, Zedaya, must mourn the loss of our eldest, our best. This is no place for mortals now. And it is what you wanted, is it not? To go back to your folk?
But you can't just close yourselves off and turn away. Not this time. Didn't you hear, Amaterasu? We all have to fight the Storm King. It is cowardice not to.
Her stern, soft face was suddenly before him again, at least in memory. Her magnificently knowing eyes.
Calm yourself, young friend, Jiriki said with a tight, angry smile. You are full of good intentions, but you do not know enough to speak so forcefully.
His expression softened.
Fear not, Seoman. Things are changing. The Hikadeya have killed our eldest, struck her down in our own sacred house. They have crossed a line that cannot be recrossed. Perhaps they meant to, but that matters less than the fact that it has happened. That is another reason for you to leave, man-child. There is no place for you in the war councils of the Zedaya.
Then you're going to fight?
Simon felt a sudden pinch of hope at his heart. Jiriki shrugged.
Yes, I think so. But how or when is not for me to say.
It's all so much, Simon murmured. So fast.
You must go, young friend.
Hadito will return soon from attending my parents. She will take you to where you can find your folk. It is best done swiftly, since it is not usual for Shimaonari or Lekemea to undo their own words of decree.
Go. My sister will come to you, at my house by the river.
Jiriki leaned down and lifted something from the mossy floor.
And do not forget to take your mirror, my friend.
He smiled slyly.
You may need to call me again, and I still owe you a life.
Simon took the gleaming thing and slid it into his pocket. He hesitated, then leaned forward and carefully wrapped his arms around Jiriki, trying not to touch his burns as he gently embraced him. The Scythi prince touched Simon's cheek with his cool lips.
Go in peace, Seoman Snorlock. We will meet again. That is a promise.
Farewell, Jiriki.
He turned and marched swiftly away without looking back. He slowed his pace after he stumbled once in the winding hallway, a long, wind-rippled tunnel the color of sand. Outside, immersed in a swirl of confused thoughts, Simon suddenly realized that he was feeling a curious chill. Looking up, he saw that the summery skies over Zhao E Tanukai had darkened, taking on a more somber hue. The breeze was colder than any he had ever felt there before.
The summer is fading, he thought, and was frightened again. I don't think they'll ever get it back.
Suddenly, all his petty anger toward the Scythi evaporated, and a great heavy sorrow for them overtook him. Whatever else was here, there was also beauty unseen since the world was young, long preserved against the killing frosts of time. Now the walls were tumbling down before a great wintry wind. Many exquisite things might be ravaged beyond reclaiming. He hurried along the riverbank toward Jiriki's house. The journey out of Zhao E Tanukai passed swiftly for Simon, dim and slippery as a dream. Aditu sang in her family's tongue, and Simon held her hand tightly as the forest shimmered and changed around them. They walked out of cool, grayish-blue skies into the very jaws of winter, which had lain in wait like a stalking beast. Snow covered the forest floor, a blanket so thick and cold that it was hard for Simon to remember that Zhao E Tanukai itself had not been covered. That in that one place, winter was still held at bay. Here, outside the magical circle of the Zedaya, The Storm King's handiwork was so terribly real. But now, he realized, even that circle had been broken. Blood had been spilled in the very heart of summer. They walked through the morning and early afternoon, gradually leaving the densest part of the woods and moving toward the forest fringe. Aditu answered Simon's few questions, but neither had the strength for much talk, as though the awful cold had withered the affection that had once flowered between them. As uncomfortable as her presence had often made him, still Simon was saddened. But the world had changed somehow, and he had no more strength to struggle. He let the winter world flow over him like a dream and did not think. They walked for some hours beside a swift river, following it until they reached a long, gentle slope. Before them lay a vast body of water, as grey and mysterious as an alchemist's bowl. A shadowed, tree-covered hill jutted from it like a dark pestle.
"There is your destination, Xiomen,"
Aditu said abruptly.
"That is Seswatra?"
"The stone of farewell?" Aditu nodded.
"The leave-taking stone."
The abstraction finally made real, Simon felt as though he were stepping from one dream into another.
"But how will I get there? Am I supposed to swim?"
Aditu said nothing, but led him down the slope to where the river rushed into the grey water, spilling across the rocks with a roar. A little distance along the shoreline, out of the way of the river's turbulent inflow, a small silvery boat bobbed at anchor.
"Once every 100 or so winters," she said, "when the rains are particularly fierce, the lands around Seswatra flood. Although this is certainly the first time it has ever happened when Reniku, the summer lantern, was in the sky."
She turned away, unwilling to share thoughts written on her face so that even a mortal could understand.
"We keep these hianha, these boats, here and there, so that Seswatra will not be denied to those who wish to visit it."
Simon put his hand on the little boat, feeling the smooth grain of the wood beneath his fingers. A paddle of the same silvery stuff lay in the hull.
"And you're sure that's where I go?"
he asked, suddenly unwilling to say goodbye. Aditu nodded.
"Yes, Xiomen."
She shrugged off the bag she had been carrying on her shoulder and handed it to him.
"This is for you." "No,"
she corrected herself.
"Not for you. It is for you to take to your Prince Joshua from Amarasu. She said she believed he would know what to do with it. If not now, then soon."
"Amarasu? She sent this?"
Aditu put a hand on his cheek.
"Not exactly, Xiomen. First grandmother had asked me to take it if your imprisonment did not end. Since you have been released, I give it to you."
She stroked his face.
"I am glad for your sake that you are free. It pained me to see you so unhappy. It was good to know of you. A rare thing."
She leaned forward and kissed him. Despite all that had happened, he still felt a quickening of his heart as her mouth touched his. Her lips were warm and dry and tasted of mint. Aditu stepped away.
"Farewell, Snowlock. I must go back and mourn."
Before he could even lift his hand to wave, she turned and disappeared among the trees. He watched for some moments, looking for some sign of her slender form, but she was gone. He turned and clambered into the small boat, and set the sack she had given him down in the hall. It was of good weight, but he was too weary and sore-hearted even to look at what might be inside. He thought it might be peaceful to fall asleep here in the boat, at the edge of the great forest. It would be a blessing to sleep and not wake for a year and a day. Instead, he picked up his paddle and pushed himself out onto the still water. The afternoon fell away, and the deep chill of evening came on. As Simon floated toward the growing shadow of Seswadra, he felt the silence of the winter world envelop him, until he thought he might be the only living, moving thing upon the face of Ostenard. For a long time, he did not notice that there were torches bobbing before him on the twilight shoreline. When he saw them at last, he was already close enough to hear the voices. His arms were cold and numb. He felt as though he had no more strength left to paddle, but managed to push himself a few last strokes, until a large, splashing shape, Sludig, waded out from the rocky verge and pulled him into shore. He was lifted from the boat and half-carried up the bank, then surrounded by an army of torchlit, laughing faces. They seemed familiar, but the sensation of dream was upon him again. It was not until he saw the smallest figure that he remembered where he was. He staggered forward and swept Binnebik into his arms, crying unashamedly.
"Simon, friend!" Binnebik chortled, thumping him on the back with his small hands. "Kinkeeper is good, joyful. This is joyful. In the days since I was coming here, I had almost lost my hope to see you."
Simon wept, unable to speak. At last, when he had cried himself dry, he set the little man down.
"Binnebik," he said, voice raw. "Oh, Binnebik, I have seen terrible things."
"Not now, Simon, not now."
The troll took his hand firmly.
"Come, come up to the hilltop. Fires have been built there, and I am sure there is something cooking. Come."
The little man led him. The crowd of familiar strangers fell in behind, talking and laughing among themselves. The flames of the torches hissed beneath a soft fall of snow, and sparks rose into the sky to drift and fade. Soon one of them began to sing, a good, homely sound. As darkness crept over the drowned valley, the sweet, clear voice rose through the trees and echoed out over the black water. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Stone of Farewell, Memory, Sorrow and Thorn, Book 2, by Tad Williams. Copyright 2015, Robert Paul Tad Williams, published by permission of DAW Books. Recording copyright, Hodder and Stoughton, 2015. All rights reserved. For more information about this and all of our unabridged audiobooks, please visit www.hodder.co.uk.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.